Hi friends, Kennedy sent through the questions that were outstanding after our last session, and I wondered whether this might be a good way to do it. Just to very quickly hit some of these on the head, I know they're going to come up as we keep going, but as we are experimenting with questions and how to get them in, let's try this as a version of me giving a little comment on each of these questions that came in. First of all, one was, so how do we as Westerners, regardless of how much we actually financially have, not qualify as Anuim? Or do we as Westerners qualify as Anuim? Anuim, of course, are the people group that Jesus seems to be referring to, who were the poor, the toklos, but who were also had their hopes pinned on the temple and on the Messiah. And again, the idea is that you're poor or you're Anuim because you don't know where your resources are coming from. And one of the things that's happening in these texts and in all the Gospels is that everyone is considered to be poor. Like all of Jesus' people are considered to be poor. So it's like he's saying, none of you actually know where your resources are coming from the next day. You're poor in spirit. Not just poor in money, although that does come into it, but we all need our daily bread. Even the rich people who are storing up in barns, even the Pharisees and the elite, they also are actually Anuim and they just don't know it. They also don't have enough resources to get them through the day because we don't have anything unless the Lord gives it to us. So what Jesus is doing is he's taking a category which has a definite referent to a definite group of people, and he's saying, essentially, I want us all to be like this or to know that we are already like this. If you are my followers, one of the things you do is you start to realize that you are also not in charge of your own resources. You are not the master of your own universe. And that's part of what's going on. He's reframing or reimagining us as we move through the world. So even rich people become poor in this sense, but also likewise, even poor people become rich. Because even the ones who are destitute, if they are locked in or plugged into a Sermon on the Mount type community, there will be no poor amongst us. Everyone is sharing what they have. There's a generosity and open-handedness to it. A lot of this stuff, I'm going to talk about it in person when we meet, but a lot of this has to do with not about setting a Sermon on the Mount that's going to apply to all people all the time and enforced from some kind of top-down utopian socialist empire. This isn't about political domination. This is about small groups of people living this way. They're not forcing it on the world around them. There's a high realization that, in fact, the whole world isn't going to follow this. And so a lot of what's going on in the Sermon on the Mount is a description of the people who follow Jesus, not a solution to the world's economic and financial and legal ills. So this isn't actually a blueprint for a socialist utopia or some sort of free market freedom of the individual system. This is not what's going on here. It's an orientation, a frame of mind, a new way of thinking about the world that comes from people who are self-consciously following in the ways of Jesus. Okay, the next question that came in has to do with taking people to court. And in fact, this is going to come up in our discussion. So I'm going to not deal with it here in the question and answer part. I'm going to deal with that when it arrives in the passages that we're looking at. But it's a good question. Don't worry, we're going to get to it. Another question. I've seen verses 14 to 16 about being the light of the world to be primarily preached as go evangelize strangers daily, weekly, or else you're being ashamed of Jesus and hiding yourself under a basket. Can you speak to this interpretation? Do we actually need to evangelize, i.e. make more Christians, or do we need to make disciples? What is a disciple? Well, lots of stuff here to unpack in this. First of all, being a light to the world is not about evangelizing. And it's not even really about making disciples. At the end of the book, Gospel of Matthew, Jesus will say, go and make disciples of all nations, which would be to not turn nations Christian. It would be to take disciples out of the nation. So you're withdrawing, you're drawing people out of their nations into an allegiance to the Jesus kingdom, first of all. And yes, it's about discipleship, not about converting, which is different. A discipleship is the process that assumes relationship. It assumes being plugged into the community. It assumes being learning ways of life, habits and forms of life. And that is a far cry from what in practice is now conversion to Christianity, which we can talk about in person later. But again, what passes for evangelism today is just, well, it's just nonsense. It's so far removed from what one finds in the early Christian imagination or the early New Testament imagination. It's so far removed that you might as well not even bother. Like, the more I study the Sermon on the Mount, the more I study the Gospels, the less interested I am in Christianity as an apparatus, as a religion, as a movement. Like, the Christian impulse and practices for some of these things are so wrong that you might as well just forget about it. It doesn't apply. The stuff that you learned as an evangelical about what it is to evangelize does not apply to the New Testament. And we can talk more about this in person. But the city on the hill, the light on the hill, is a reference to Israel being a light to all Gentiles. It's an Old Testament allusion to what a restored Israel is and does. And it's a light to the nations. It's the beacon that other people are drawn to, which again fits with what Jesus talks about at the end of the book of Matthew, where he gives the Great Commission to go and make disciples of all nations, to draw people out of their nations. And that's what the city on the hill does as well. People are drawn to the light. You're not, a city on a hill isn't going out finding people. It's doing what it does as best as it can, and people come to it. And that's what's happening with the Sermon on the Mount communities. They are doing what they do because it's the right thing to do, because it's a symbol of the new creation, because it's a way to bring peace and light and love to the people who are in those communities. And that naturally will lead to some people being attracted to it. And it also will lead to the darkness being even more pronounced. One of the side effects of a light shining in the darkness is that the darkness is even more deep all around it. The contrast is even sharper. And so much of Christian evangelism in the New Testament, as opposed to Christian evangelicalism, which is all about winning arguments and defeating people's opposition to you, or changing the culture so that there's no choice, people have to be Christian. In the New Testament, the followers of Jesus are essentially getting on with the job of being followers of Jesus, and they are welcoming people who want to join them. And then they are forming those people into their image. They're teaching them what it means. They're discipling them what it would mean. And they are, in fact, resisting the lure of the quick and easy convert. And we could talk about that as well. But the people who instantly come and want to follow, or who are attracted to the power or the healing or the demon miracles, these are the people who are often treated with some suspicion. Not everyone who shouts, "Lord, Lord," is welcomed, for example, or is endorsed. And you'll even see in, for example, the book of Acts, when 3,000 are added to their number in one day, this is even the beginning of part of the problem as well for the early church. So mass conversion to the faith is in fact part of the beginning of the problem of separating discipleship and conversion. And you even start to see that play out in the book of Acts. But the vision is of doing the work of living the way Jesus asked his people to live and attracting enemies and friends or fellow travelers in measure, in maybe not equal measure, but in like measure. So it's not about trying to defeat arguments. It's not about that. It's about being a faithful witness. The idea is being a presence, a faithful presence in the world, a faithful witness to the kingship of Jesus by, look how they will know that you are my disciples by how you love. is one thing Jesus says. And how you love each other is nothing if not an order and a rule for life. It's a way of life. And how you love each other is often reflected here in Sermon on the Mount. So we really need to flick that switch about what being a light is, or what even being an evangelical or evangelism is. You don't preach the good news so much as you just are the good news, and see what happens when you just do it. You pick and mix. You choose which laws apply and which don't. Who decides? All right, here's a question about picking and mixing, and who decides? The Bible-thumping preacher, do they get to decide? No, it's not pick and mix. It isn't this sort of willy-nilly, like, oh, we get to decide whatever we want. It's we affirm what Jesus affirmed, and we don't affirm what he didn't affirm. It's really that simple. And what that does mean is it requires you to have a much more open-handed view. You don't think of the Bible as a magic book that fell from the sky fully formed. You don't think of the Old Testament's laws as all equally valid with the words of Jesus. You don't say things like, if we don't think that Job existed, or if we don't think that Genesis 1 and 2 is a literal beginning of the earth, then we can't believe that Jesus rose from the dead, or we can't believe the words of Jesus. If you equate all the words and teachings of the scriptures of the Old Testament to the Gospels or to the life of Jesus, then you are making a God out of a book. You are saying that all these words are equally valid and equally important to Jesus, and they are not. They are not equally valid, and they are not equally important. And Jesus is the lens, the measuring rod. This is what the early Christians did. They just said he is the measure of all things. And that's what that means. He's the measure of all things. So we use Jesus to measure all things. And if Jesus wouldn't have committed genocide or dashed babies' heads on rocks, then when we read that in the book of Joshua, for example, even though it says God told them to do it, we, with some legitimacy, get to say, nope, God didn't tell them to do that, because Jesus wouldn't have told them to do that. And that there are things in the Old Testament which God says, which Jesus comes along and asks us to rethink. And that complicates your evangelical vision of the Bible is evangelical's problem. But it's not a problem for early Christianity. The early Christians were very used to that, and this was in fact one of their projects, as your question even rightly pointed out in the book of Hebrews. The early Christians are very much used to this idea. Now, they're not picking and choosing. They have quite a rigorous way of applying it. They are using Jesus as their method. And they are having lots of arguments about which parts of the Old Testament Jesus did affirm and didn't affirm. But if you'll see that is their measure, at least they're trying, right? Unlike modern evangelicals today who don't even try. They just quite happily will equate various, especially when it comes to violence, they'll very happily just hold up all sorts of violent God passages in the Old Testament and use that explicitly as an excuse to ignore Jesus in the New Testament. And that, to me, is not only is it intellectually stupid and moral imbecility, it's also just it fails by its own logic. It's anti-Christian by its own logic. Because if you're a Christian and you think that Jesus was the incarnate word of God, then you don't think that Jesus' words can be measured and argued with and set against other words and discarded when you don't like what they say. So there is a kind of an intellectual and moral imbecility in conservative even, or in most Christians, which is part of my disgust at them, that they don't even abide by their own rules, and they don't seem to understand what it might mean to actually say Jesus is God, Jesus is Lord, which is a big claim to make. But once you've made that, then everything else falls into place, including the Hebrew scriptures. And those Bible-thumping preachers that you mentioned in your question, almost certainly a Bible-thumping preacher is not applying the Christological hermeneutic to the Bible. They are not using Jesus as their measure of everything. They are using the Bible as their measure of everything. and they love to be proud about how well they thump the Bible and how well they talk about the Bible. But really what they're doing is they are using the Bible. Almost always it comes down to justify their nationalist or patriotic values. So almost without exception, the Bible-thumping preacher types are the ones who are, whatever Jesus says or the Sermon on the Mount will say something that challenges their patriotic self-assertion, then they will find the Old Testament passages which will affirm them. And that's the ones they'll go for. And then they will claim that they are Bible-believing Christians. When in fact, it's pretty patently obvious that all that's happening is they are having an imagination shaped by the values of nationalism and patriotism and self-sufficiency and tribal conflict, protecting what's theirs against other people, protecting what for people who look like them and sound like them as much as possible, shoring up and hoarding resources, killing enemies, all that stuff that comes with running a nation, making a nation great again. Those are the things Bible-thumping preachers love. And those are all the things that Jesus said not to do. So Bible-thumping preachers don't really know anything about the Bible. You can ignore them. They are morons. Okay, down the road from us is one of the poorest areas of our city. Do you have any thoughts on how we tell people we meet that they're actually blessed? Well, we don't. Well, okay. Well, first of all, it's very morally offensive to go to a poor person and say you are blessed and then keep walking. And even the book of James knows this from as long ago as 2,000 years ago. Even James will write to his people, right? He'll say, what's the point in talking about the gospel if there's people amongst you who are hungry? If there's poor amongst you who are suffering from being poor, then to just preach the gospel at them is offensive. So this was something that even the people who knew Jesus, I mean, James was Jesus's brother. They got this. They knew this right away. This is hardly a new problem that's arisen here. So it isn't about just telling poor people they're blessed. There's two things going on. First of all, at one level, the people who are open-handed and generous with their money, who are fearless with their resources, who are not identifying themselves only with their tribe or the rights of their group against other groups, the people who are actually living a Sermon on the Mount type of existence, those people will be the answer to prayer for the poor. So the blessing of the poor will come from people who are actually loving them. So when you say you are blessed to a poor person, hopefully they are blessed because we're in contact with them. And more than that, because they're part of us, they're part of our community. So a lot of the fulfillment of the blessings comes from actually being the people, being the thing. So when we also recognize that we are not self-sufficient, that we are poor as well, even though we are rich in money, we recognize that we are unaware of where our resources are going to come from, well, then that is part of the mindset that gets changed and transformed, which allows us to have sympathy and solidarity with other types of poor people, because we realize we also are poor and we're not building up some sort of a tribal defense against poor people, where we're the rich and you're the poor, and now we're going to have some sort of class warfare about this, or some kind of patriarchal duty towards you. It changes when you realize we're all poor. We're all poor in spirit. And then it also changes when you realize that the poor are also rich in different ways, like I was saying before. So one of the ways you can say that the poor are blessed is that, well, for one thing, they're blessed because Jesus has given them his preference. Because the one word that gets said over and over and over again by the prophets in the Hebrew Scriptures, which is, by the way, one of the words that Jesus affirms. So one of the things we can affirm in the Old Testament is the prophetic words, the prophets, who are always against the rich. They're always against the priests and the kings who are elite and who are established and secure in their comfortableness and sure of their rightness and sure of their traditional family values and their nationalist, patriotic fortresses that they've built for themselves. And the prophets always come to those people and say, woe to you, you've forgotten the cause of the oppressed. God is on their side. He's not on your side. He hates your sacrifices because you aren't giving mercy. So in a way, if you think God is real, and if you think Jesus is good, well then, there is a form of blessing in saying, Jesus is for you, and he's not for those people who are oppressing you. The oppressors are not with God, even though they use his name loudly, or even though they like to put his name at the end of their services and their political rhetoric and on their money. In reality, God is for you, not for them. But of course, the truth of those words are only going to be heard when the poor people actually experience God being for them, and that's only going to happen through people who claim to follow God or follow Jesus, which is meant to be the same thing. So the blessing comes from saying you are blessed, a bit like the angel appearing to Mary and saying you are blessed. Today God's favor is on you. So that could be a bit like that, like poor people, you are blessed. God's favor is upon you. And poor people, you are blessed because we're going to damn well going to do something about it. Because we're with you, we're for you, we are not better than you. In fact, we're equal. We also are poor, and we're going to share what we have. The other thing to add, though, is like I said before, a lot of this ethic is not about reframing an entire nation's economic structure. It's about people of Jesus acting like Jesus to each other. And then folding people into that. So people are coming into the community. And there is a high sense that the Sermon on the Mount is an ethic for people who are already followers of Jesus, of which anybody can be one and everyone is welcome. But it is still an insider-outsider ethic going on here. And this isn't some sort of blanket law to apply to everybody. And so a poor person who is a follower of Jesus is in a different category than a poor person who is not a follower of Jesus. And I think perhaps our attitudes towards them can shift accordingly. But it shouldn't lead to some elitism. It should just lead to there is an insider-outsider dynamic going on, and anyone can be this insider. That seems to be the plan. And also a lot of people who claim to be insiders turn out to be outsiders because they don't like the way of Jesus. All right, another question has come in linking all the Sermon on the Mount to Paul in Romans 12, 9 to 21, which is well worth reading. Is this what Paul is replaying in Romans 12, 9 to 21 when he describes love in action? Well, yes. Yes, this is an echo. This is one of those places where Jesus is being quoted by Paul or referred to. It's a window into the early church imagination, the early Christian imagination of a society that is actually forming itself around these things, like we're seeing in the Sermon on the Mount. They're forming themselves around the ethic that Jesus was living and preaching. And you see Paul do this. There's quite a lot of good stuff we could say about this, but you're right. Romans 12, 9 to 21 is an example of Paul speaking back to the early Christians something they already knew or had heard or were living out, which is marks of the true follower of Jesus, which is all about do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Do not seek vengeance. If your enemy is hungry, feed them. It's an explication or an understanding of the Sermon on the Mount. Unlike recognized in almost any Christian groups today. So this is not a defense of Christianity by any means, even though it is a defense of the goodness of Jesus. It is worth pointing out that in Romans 12, 9 to 21, 21 ends with do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. And immediately following is Romans 13, 1. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities. Paul's example of what overcoming evil with good is to be subject to the ruling authorities. Paul thinks the ruling authorities are something of the devil. There is something evil about them, and it is our job as followers of Jesus to submit to them for a time. Paul also says in Romans 12, 9 to 21, where he's directly referencing Jesus, he also says, do not seek revenge. And then later on in Romans 13, he'll say, it's the government that seeks revenge and that holds the sword. So something that he's told followers of Jesus not to do, which everyone assumes, of course, they wouldn't do that because they're followers of Jesus, then becomes the thing that a government should do, which tells you that in the early Christian imagination, there were a rule of life for followers of Jesus, which did not apply to the wider national empires around them. And there was an expectation that followers of Jesus were not necessarily ever going to be rulers of empires. That wasn't their job. That wasn't the expectation. They were doing what they needed to do to be a witness to the world. And the world was doing what the world needed to do to punish the wrongdoer and to protect justice at the point of a sword. And there is a sort of a purpose to it, to restrain evil. But Paul and his earliest followers of Jesus all recognized that their rule of life was different than the state's rule of life, and that what they were doing was of a different order, which is part of what the Sermon on the Mount is meant to be. This isn't about applying the Sermon on the Mount to the whole world, and it's certainly not about forcing converts at the point of a sword or some cultural bullying tactic. It's about getting on with doing the job of treating others better than yourself, not repaying evil for evil, seeking reconciliation above all else, heart's transformation, social and political and economic reimagination of what it is we're doing in this world, and where our allegiances lie, and the rest follows.